In the news.
Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Government. I'm Eric McDaniel.
And I'm Jim Henson.
All right, so this week, again, as almost every week, we've been talking about the primaries. And the state that's up to bat this week is Wisconsin. So known for giving us great cheese and beer. And the Packers.
Bratwurst.
Oh, that's right, bratwurst. Sausage. Yes, yes. I won't mention the Brewers because I'm a Cardinals fan. Plus, I'm a respectable baseball fan. But we have some updates out of this. So we see a bit of intrigue. So Wisconsin's also brought us intrigue this week. I'm not talking about Bo Ryan's affair, but we're talking here about Hillary Clinton losing to Bernie Sanders in Wisconsin, as well as Donald Trump losing to Ted Cruz. And so people have argued that for Hillary Clinton, it means it's going to take a little bit longer for her to wrap up the nomination. And again, her and Bernie have gotten kind of some heated arguments lately. I think, you know, with Hillary Clinton arguing that Bernie Sanders should apologize for some of the attacks he's made on her. But on the Republican side, it's actually more intriguing because we're seeing here is the probability of a contested convention really becoming almost an absolute. I think some said 80%. I saw the figure today was about a 75% chance of that happening because Trump is losing steam. I don't think anybody will be able to, nobody will have the majority, but it looks like Trump will go with a plurality, but it's going to be a very close plurality.
Yeah, I mean, a big problem here for Trump was obviously the bad week he's had with women. It's just now stretching into a couple of bad weeks. Now, I think there's a, and we've talked about this before, there's a real tendency to be a little bit myopic. Like the contest that is right in front of us, we're always going, you know, okay, this time Cruz and Sanders won, the worm's turning. This is probably a bump on the road. Once we go to the northeastern states, New York, a couple others in that region, and mid-Atlantic states, those are likely to be pretty good for the people we think of as that are the front runners, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Nonetheless, after many times of Donald Trump seeming to step on it and seeming to be in trouble and then recovering, the week he had with women was pretty terrible last week. And it had started even when we did the last podcast, and then it got worse. And the thing that got the most publicity was Donald Trump's comments on women in relationship to abortion in a clip with Chris Matthews. We're going to roll that sound. I want to apologize ahead of time that, you know, Chris Matthews is going to yell at everybody in this a little bit. So let's roll that clip and talk about it afterwards.
Should the woman be punished for having an abortion? Look,
this is not something you can dodge.
If abortion is a crime or
abortion is murder, you have to deal with it under the law. Should abortion be punished?
Well, people in certain parts of the Republican Party and conservative Republicans would say, yes, they should be punished.
How about you?
I would say that it's a very serious problem, and it's a problem that we have to decide on. It's very hard.
But you're forbidding it.
Are you going to say, well, wait, are you going to say put them in jail? Is that the
punishment
that
you're talking about? Well, no, what I'm asking you, because you say you want to ban it. What's that mean?
I am pro-life, yes.
What is ban? How do you ban abortion? How do you actually do it?
Well, you know, you'll go back to a position like they had, where people will perhaps go to illegal places.
Yeah.
But you have to ban it.
You ban it, and they go to somebody who flunked out of medical school.
You Catholic?
Yes, I think
how do you feel about the Catholic Church's position?
I accept the teaching authority of my church on moral issues.
But do you know their position on abortion?
Yes, I do.
And do you concur with that position?
I concur with their moral position, but legally question. Here's my problem.
But let me ask you. But what do you say about
it's not funny.
Your church? Yeah, it's really not a funny thing. What do you say about your church? They're very, very strong.
They're allowed to, but the churches make their moral judgments. But you running for president of the United States will be chief executive of the United States. Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah, there has to be some form.
Ten years?
I don't know. I don't
know. You take positions on everything else.
I do take positions on everything else. It's a very complicated position.
Painful.
I actually felt sympathy for... I'm lying. Yeah, I mean, Chris Matthews got in, was basically like a dog on a bone. You keep saying, you're not going to get out of this. You're not going to get out of this. I'm going to, you know, and any question Trump had, he answered very quickly. But this isn't about me. This is about you. And in many ways, it felt like, you know, Chris Matthews was talking to my six-year-old. Quit trying to change the subject. What did I tell you to do? What are we talking about? Focus here. And it's clear he does not want to answer that question.
Yeah, I mean, and he also, I mean, he tries the classic Trump, you know, counterpunch. Let's talk about your Catholicism. What do you think? Yeah. And you can see Trump even wavering some as he's answering the question. And as he, and to the extent that he wavered in that, he wavered a lot more in the 36 hours or so following this interview. And rather than play a string of the Trump clips, let's go to the Saturday Night Live recap of this and what Saturday Night Live did with this, which then in turn drove a lot of media coverage over the weekend.
Women's History Month really ended on a high note. During an MSNBC town hall on Wednesday, Trump said women should be punished for getting abortion. Then an hour later, he said doctors should be punished. Then an hour after that, he said we should just let the states decide. Then the next day, he said, you know what, let's just leave the laws alone. Before finally saying yesterday, when I'm president, I'm going to change those laws. So at this point, Donald Trump has to be pro-choice, because he's made all of the choices.
Also, Donald Trump, how do you not already have a stock answer for an abortion question? You're on MSNBC. What do you think they're gonna ask you? Their number one show is, so what do you think about abortion? And the answer is never, women should be punished. I don't even care what the question is. You don't say that on TV. Even if you're on Wheel of Fortune and the board says, women should be punished. Say it. How do you fall for that setup? Chris Matthews basically asked, a sexist says what? And your answer was, I'm a sexist and women should be punished.
They pretty much had their way with Donald Trump on that. But it does get to a real problem for the Trump campaign that has been compounded. And, you know, that clip was from Saturday Night Live, but basically pulled from the CNN coverage, which tells you something. You know, this problem that Trump is having with women voters. And I think the way to think about this, as some people have said, this is a problem because women aren't an interest group. They're more than half of the electorate. It is a huge deal and a huge problem. And we're seeing that, and we've seen it almost immediately in Trump's approval numbers, his favorability numbers among women. So the morning after, you know, basically over the weekend, Gallup released a poll with the fave unfazed for Donald Trump. His unfavorable ratings have been rising pretty steadily among women. It was at 70%. And that's about a 14% gap if you compare that to his fave unfaves among men. So if you look at those, he's also been, you know, having some trouble with his favorability ratings flattening or going down, his unfaves going up, but a pretty big gap between men and women. We've seen this in polling in Texas as well. We did some favorability ratings for Trump in Texas, and you know his negatives among women were at about 64 as of February.
Yeah, I mean he started off low to begin with. He didn't have the best reputation with women. I mean, the best way to think about this is he was one of the favorite guests of Howard Stern, and so. You really think of Howard Stern as a feminist. But what also paints into this is that, again, for the general campaign, this would fit with this larger argument the Democratic Party has, but the GOP has a war against women. And so saying that women should be punished for abortion becomes problematic. And one of the things that's coming out as we're talking more about abortion more is realizing that abortions are not as rare as we thought. I believe one institute estimates that it's somewhere between 25 to 33%, or so somewhere between 1 in 4 to 1 in 3 women have had an abortion. So that's a lot of women going to be punished if you're going to follow through with this policy. And so one of the things is going to really push us to the forefront is, okay, what do we do about this abortion issue? What do we do about, you know, women's right to choose? And if we decide to punish, well, who gets punished, who doesn't? Because we really don't have that many, the data on abortion really isn't that well kept because it's a private issue, it's a controversial issue. But saying that women should be punished when we have a sizable portion of the female population that is having an abortion presents all kinds of problems. And I mean, be truthful, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, people at the DNC were kind of dancing a jig when they heard this. You know, they may have been crumping, doing the wobble because they thought, hey, we got something good for them. So he stepped in it. We'll see if he can step out of it.
Yeah, I mean, the Saturday Night Live skit really did get directly at something that was pretty amazing about that is that, as much as we've talked about Trump, you know, the mixture of where, you know, the degree to which Donald Trump is both a good candidate and the way that he's transferred some of these marketing skills and the way that he is not a traditional political candidate was really on display here, in the sense that, you know, he walked into a haymaker in that interview and, you know, it's like he just got sucker punched. He didn't see it coming at all, even though he should have.
Michael Jason, you're on MSNBC. What do you expect?
Yeah, and you have to have a better answer than that, no matter where you are. And part of it is not just about being a candidate either. It's also about having a thoughtful position on something that you know is complex and you know is going to come up. So we should probably move away from the campaign, though it's kind of hard. I mean, this is like, it's a thing. You start talking about, no matter where I am, you start talking about Donald Trump and it just goes in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot going on. Because I mean, what's really important is why we're spending all this time talking about Donald Trump, who also came out with a plan to force Mexico to build the wall by stopping money transfers from the U.S. to Mexico. But we really haven't really talked much about Cruz's platform or Kasich's platform, and even Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders' platforms as much, because we've been talking about the spectacle that is Donald Trump's campaign.
So I feel a little like we've fallen for it, just like everyone else has.
Yeah, but, you know.
What can you do? I mean, it is significant. It's a significant change. It's a significant shift and a significant phenomenon in the political system.
So very much so.
I feel okay about it. You feel okay about it?
Yeah, you know, hey, it's all about the customers.
I think we've now made ourselves feel better about it.
Yeah.
Elsewhere in the political system, the Supreme Court this week handed down a significant redistricting decision based on a lawsuit filed in Texas nominally against the Texas leadership. It was Evenwell v. Abbott. And the court decided in that case that against the plaintiffs. And the argument in this case was that Texas should not be running their redistricting system, that is, the process by which district lines in Congress and the state legislature are drawn according to population. What the plaintiffs were saying was that, in fact, if you're going to respect the principle of one person, one vote, rather than apportioning districts by population, you should apportion them by some basis that has to do with either registered voters or voter turnout. I think that the case was actually asking for registered voters or even voting age population. And the court threw out this decision, and one of the big surprises, Eric, was that it was an 8-0 decision.
Yeah, and this has been one of the big issues, like, oh, we got all these 4-4 decisions, 6-2, but this was an 8-0 decision where basically like, yeah, no, we're not buying this. And so I found that to be extremely interesting. Now, again, as has been pointed out, the decision left some openings. It didn't necessarily slam the door shut, but it did leave some openings. But it was basically arguing that, look, you know, you can use different calculations for drawing up your districts, but what you're proposing will not work.
Right. In other words, you can't constitutionally mandate that use one system and one system only for drawing districts. And so what's interesting about this is that from the perspective of a lot of legal scholars, what we're likely to see is that it's not this case that's fundamental, it's the next one, when another state comes up with a method of drawing districts that maybe is closer to what the plaintiffs wanted in this case, which is a more restrictive view of the population, almost certainly likely to have a negative impact on minority voters. And so it's when that other system is challenged that we'll really see a more fundamental decision. Because really what this unanimous court said in this decision was that it should be left up to the states, that the federal government and the Constitution can't impose one system. Now, raising the, you know, so this is yet another issue in which we're looking at the relationship between the states and the federal government in this federal system, where there's always some competition between the national government, the state government, and local governments. Now, that configuration came up in yet another way recently in the case of the passage of what are, you know, so-called religious freedom acts in the states.
So you have North Carolina passing a bill which prevented localities from passing laws that protected the rights of homosexuals. Then more recently, Mississippi passed a law which allowed individuals to discriminate against homosexuals based upon religious beliefs. Now, I know Indiana tried to pass something like this, Georgia tried to pass something like this, but it was vetoed by the governor after a significant amount of pressure was put on them. But in we see with the North Carolina and the Georgia and the Mississippi cases, they went through. Mississippi's is much more stringent, and there's a very strong backlash, specifically in North Carolina. There is a backlash against Mississippi, but the economic sanctions, things like that, in terms of business pulling out, is going to be stronger in North Carolina than Mississippi, I believe.
Yeah, this has really raised a lot of internal politics, particularly inside the Republican Party. Now, these laws are being passed exclusively in states that have Republican legislatures and Republican governors. So these, you know, there's a real partisan element to this that's driving a lot of the politics here. And I think we're gonna see more of that. And you see it reflected in public opinion. There's been talk about these kinds of laws in Texas. We polled on this in the UT Texas Tribune poll last year. We asked, do you think that businesses should be allowed to refuse services to gays and lesbians for religious reasons? So if you look at those results, overall, it was 41% said that businesses should be allowed to refuse services. 45% said they should. Actually, the other way around, right? No.
So 41 is be allowed to discriminate.
Right. Should be allowed to refuse services. 46 was should not be allowed to refuse services. Some people, so pretty evenly divided. If you break that down by party, you really see how much of a partisan issue this is in public opinion and why this is driving politics in Republican-dominated states. So 64% of Republicans supported allowing businesses to refuse services. 73% of Democrats didn't support that. Clear partisan divide. This is likely to come up again in Texas in the next legislative session that starts in January. I think you'll see things move through the legislature. If they get through the legislature, the governor is likely to sign it. But this is one of those grayer areas because it divides business from the base. And businesses in Texas, big business associations like the Texas Association of Business, have already come out as skeptical of these things because of the dampening effect it has on recruiting businesses to the state. The governor will sign it, but my guess is he'd probably just as soon support it publicly, but privately not be all that eager for it to come to his desk and for him to have to choose between the base and the business community.
Yeah, and this isn't a very important issue. I mean, the pressure that was put on Georgia and Indiana was, okay, fine, you want to sign this bill. The NCAA was like, we'll take the tournaments away from Indianapolis. Super Bowl, the NFL took the Super Bowls away from Georgia. You know, and so you have a lot of major events going on in these states. And the idea of separating the business interests from, I guess, the social conservative interests is a classic thing. So the primary example of this, and Professor Shaw talked about this in the lecture, was the Montgomery bus boycott. And with the Montgomery bus boycott, what you saw going on is a fracturing of the racial conservatives from the business interest. And so while they had kind of worked hand in hand early on, this long, drawn out boycott basically started to hurt the business interest quite a bit to the point where they're like, okay, look, we can't have this going on anymore. And this has kind of been a classic story in the South where the argument has been, you know, you stop lynching in the South, not because people said lynching is bad, because it was bad business. You couldn't get Northern businesses down. And you see the same thing going on here, that if you get this, you can split up this this group, so social conservatives and business conservatives working together, but if you can find a way to split them, in many ways you can advance your issue. And one of the ways we're seeing the advancement of LGBT rights is through business interests, by the fact that Indiana was pressured, like, look, if you do this, the NCAA said we're going to pull out tournaments. I think maybe even the NFL threatened to take away the Super Bowl. Same thing going on in Georgia. And if you think about Texas, where we just had the NCAA championship here in Houston, planned for Super Bowl in Houston and in Dallas, a lot of these major events happening in the state of Texas, and the fact that Texas is such a large state, and Texas is actively trying to recruit businesses from other states, really puts it in this weird situation where individuals say, why would I want to move to a state that could openly discriminate against my employees? And so this becomes a humongous issue. And so you're also seeing the same thing with immigration reform. We're seeing in Arizona and in Alabama that these things may threaten business. And if it's not good for business, then it may not be, then a lot of people will move away, especially as much as Texas has prided itself on being a pro-job state. This could undercut some of the things that it wants to accomplish.
Yeah, I mean, that really gets it. That's why I think, you know, Governor Abbott has to keep that coalition together. I mean, the coalition of the traditional business sector of the Republican Party in Texas with social and a more ideological conservatives is really the linchpin of this working, and they've got a real problem. And I think there's an interesting separation of powers here thing that we see in terms of political tactics. And so my guess is we'll hear Governor Abbott talking about this some as it comes up, but not doing a lot to really push it through, particularly with, you know, already established vocal opposition by business in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, he's already passed legislation which protects clergy from having to take part in these things. Now, what's also interesting, and again, if you think of the Speaker of the House, Joe Strauss, he's a business conservative. He doesn't seem to be that high up on the social conservative aspect, so he may try to kill it early on, or he may be one of the individuals who will basically work as a surrogate for Governor Abbott to kill it early on.
That would be my guess, because the biggest impetus for this, I mean, there'll be people in the House that want it, but the people that have been most vocal on these issues have in fact been in the Texas Senate, so.
All right, so those are kind of the comments we have for this week. We have a lot of topics to discuss. So we'll be here next week to give you even more information. So you all have a good week.
So long.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Jim Henson and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.